experts. We're going to go out with more music from Northwest Dance Project's Hedda.
Positive difference in all our lives. Thank you for supporting this effort to keep Portland vital and engaged. Thank you for keeping Portland radical, and thank you for supporting KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for keeping KBOO fierce, vital, and independent, accountable to no one but you, the community.
Thank you.
Thanks for supporting KBOO.
Thank you. Thank you so much for donating to KBOO's Kickstarter to help make a city of media makers.
Thank you.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Joel W. Fisher and Jess Perlitz, Assistant Professors of Art at Lewis and Clark College. Their shows, Abridged Proof and Forever Washing Itself, are on now at the Hoffman Gallery at Lewis and Clark through Sunday the 18th of March. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Joel and Jess, you're both art teachers at Lewis and Clark College, and you're both artists, and you get this gallery, this big gallery, kind of, you get half each. So just tell us what kind of art each of you does.
Sure. So this is Joel. I'm primarily a photographer. The show that's up now is a mixture of both photographs and writing. The writing is my own writing, but it's based on a text that is combined by two other writers. But in terms of my own work, it's primarily I make photographs and video.
Mm-hmm. And Jess?
I am a sculptor, and I think about sculpture as being about the articulation of space, but it means that I have a practice where I also end up doing performance and videos and drawings under a kind of pursuit of object making.
And your sculpture, I mean, people would know, it's kind of like installation-y a bit. There are things you can do in that.
Yeah, the work I make is often participatory, not always, but it does, I would say, it always implicates the body in some way. That is the way I understand sculptures, through the body.
Great. So, Joel, your show is called Abridged Proof,
mm-hmm.
which, is that a photography term or book publishing term?
I don't think photographers use that term too often. It's more, you see it in publishing of books, and the reason why I use that as the title is because the work is two parts of an 18-part piece, and that 18-part piece is actually meant for a book publication. And initially, I didn't mean it for the walls itself, but then when this opportunity presented itself, I decided to kind of pull it out of what I usually make, which are books, and put it actually on the walls, which is a great opportunity. It really is much different. The images open up nicely, much differently than I thought they would. So why it's called the Bridge Proof is because it is an initial proof. It's the beginning of this work, and it's not the final version. I sort of, already the writing has changed from what it is. It's mostly poems that are on the walls, and it's become more prose poetry as opposed to sort of line-breaking poetry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's where the title came from.
I recently did a show about the Robert Frank show and the photographer who worked in book form a lot. Mm. So when you walk into your gallery, I didn't realize these are pictures that are designed to go in books.
Mm-hmm.
So was there any connection there?
Sure. I mean, I think in the lineage of thinking about Robert Frank's contributions to the book specifically, Robert Frank, I think in some ways, I would say maybe exploded the book format and for photographers, and I think took much more from literature than specifically thinking about, let's say, a book project that is, this is my pictures of funeral homes and here's, you know, 30 funeral homes or whatever it may be. He really thought of it as a way to bring the viewer through a journey, in essence, and broke up his book in parts and chapters as well. It's something I'm very interested in. So I really like the idea or the notion of being able to read the book as a piece of literature almost, as opposed to it being, this is a book of photographs based on this one subject. So that's really the impetus for my sort of desire to work in this format. Also, I think in terms of thinking about pictures, one of the attributes that I really am attracted to is its accessibility, also reproducibility. So the fact that it's not something that exists in a single format or even an edition of 10, it's something that could be potentially many more. So reaching a bigger audience that way is something I've also always been interested in.
Mm-hmm. So you have two pictures called The Bund, mm-hmm. The Bund 1 and 2, and they are two women leaning against the railing at a river, tourists-looking women, and one's got a selfie stick camera. Just tell us, which one is number one and which one is number two?
Sure. So number one, if you were to see the pictures, they are really similar in many ways in terms of composition. One is clearly much more refined in terms of its resolution and the way it actually reads. The first photograph is the one that I shot just with my cell phone walking by. This is on a riverbank in Shanghai. It's called the Bund because it's this bank in which during a certain time period there were all these Western banks that were along, financial banks and institutions that were along this riverbank. And and so I was walking along this space and sort of in awe of how quickly Shanghai had grown up in with skyscrapers and buildings. And I had noticed this kind of, I would say, I don't know, intersection of older technology, which is the 35mm camera around this woman's neck, and then her taking a selfie with a iPhone. And as I looked at that picture, I was really sort of taken with the composition, the triangle that's in the middle, the fact that there's a barge that sort of sits behind her, and how the cell phone actually becomes, in essence, part of the cityscape. And I thought the iPhone photo was pretty successful as an iPhone photo, but it falls apart for various reasons. So I decided to reconstruct the photograph.
When you took it, were you composing? Was all this unconscious?
With the iPhone?
Yeah, when you took the original picture.
Yeah, I mean, I probably took, you know, maybe five or six pictures, and I moved around, and I sort of looked at what was happening behind. I mean, I think as a photographer, we're often looking at what's going on in the foreground, middle ground, and background. So I was moving around a bit, but I wasn't really thinking about everything that was happening in the frame until I revisited the picture.
And then when you recreated it, did you have to go back to China?
No, it was in the same trip that I recreated.
And
it.
And who are the women?
There are two people that I found. One thing I found working in China was that it was really difficult to find people to work with in terms of putting out casting calls. I think that they were probably a bit suspicious of someone from the U.S. coming and trying to work with people. And so I actually ended up... I had an assistant who was from China, and he helped me find these two people. So it took a little while, a little digging, and then I stylized the photograph in terms of bringing in a lot of different elements, such as the reflective glasses that were repeated and are repeated from the first picture.
Mm-hmm. So the woman who's taking the selfie picture with a stick has shiny mirror sunglasses mm-hmm. on her head, and they have different bags.
Mm-hmm.
You change certain elements.
There's sure.
still the 35mm camera around her neck,
mm-hmm.
and the other woman is looking away.
Mm-hmm.
So you obviously there's a lot of coming and going, things you're keeping and ditching. How much work is that?
It's quite a bit of work in terms of decisions made. So I think, you know, if you were to sort of look at just the Buntu, maybe you wouldn't think that it was a photograph that was a revisitation of another picture. It seems as though these two women could feasibly just be in this position, looking over this riverbank, one taking a selfie, one looking beyond to the skyscrapers. But yeah, so there was a lot that went into the design of the picture. Some things I wanted to change just for aesthetic purposes. But overall, really that whole part, which is part 15, is about revisitation, something that is quite common in the medium of photography. So in essence, the entire piece, which is called Agapage, is it's kind of a meta piece that is about the medium of photography unto itself.
There's a piece called Oregon Lottery, which is a hand making the crossed fingers sign, which is the logo of the Oregon Lottery, and the hand's in front of a red painted wall. Why did you make that?
When I first moved to Portland, it was for the position at Lewis and Clark, and I was biking to work a lot, and I would see this logo all over the place, and I thought it was kind of a really funny logo, and I found this red wall, and I was like, oh, I actually like to recreate this picture or this image. And one day I was sitting in a coffee shop, and I just heard this voice, and it was unmistakable that it was a Baldwin, and it happens to be Daniel Baldwin. And so I kind of listened to him for a little while, and then I just approached him and asked him if he would consider being in this picture. And so the hand is actually Daniel Baldwin's hand.
Well, hang on, which of the Baldwins is this?
It's, there's four, right? So he's one that lives here.
really?
Yeah, he lives, he was in Lake Oswego, but now lives in Portland.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if
and
I would
say
that
game,
he's the...
game for a laugh?
He was. I mean, I explained to him the picture and what I was aiming to do, and yeah, and he was totally into it. So I think as long as his face wasn't in the photograph, he didn't really care. So the actual title of the picture is Oregon Lottery, Daniel Baldwin Crossing His Fingers.
Mm-hmm. Then you have another one called Ice Cream Scooper, 1, 2, and 3, which is an older waiter with some ice cream, but there are three pictures of him in different poses.
Yeah.
What is that all about?
So before I became a professor, I worked various jobs as a photographer, and one of them was as a wedding photographer. And so I was interested in sort of also the labor, and one of the things I'm interested in photography is the fact that it does span many different kinds of uses, practical, but also fine art. And so I worked many different jobs as a photographer, and when I was working as a wedding photographer, I saw this older gentleman who was scooping ice cream, and I thought it was really interesting thinking about sort of labor practice. And he's the actual picture that this is based on, the guy was actually quite a bit older. And then I took, you know, maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 pictures of this guy while he was scooping ice cream. And then I decided to remake the photograph. And in remaking it, I found a location, lit it very similar to the lighting of this event that was this wedding venue. And the experience of sort of revisiting was much different than shooting an actual wedding, which is, you know, shooting event happens really quickly. So this is a much more slowed down process and paying attention to very specific details like the bow tie, the position that he's in looking back at the camera, the lighting overhead, the cafe lights behind.
How long was the shoot?
The revisitation? Yeah. Well, it took a little while to find a location. So I had I actually shot this when I was on sabbatical. I was in New York City and I was in a residency program there. And I had an assistant who went and looked at probably 5 or 6 different locations. And we found a great location in Harlem. So then we rented a bunch of equipment sort of midtown, then went up to Harlem and shot it up there. And it was probably about a day full for the entire shoot.
But there was no commercial purpose in this. You were paying for the rental.
Yeah, I didn't have to pay for the rental. We convinced them to let us in between events, but yeah.
But this is art for art's sake.
Yeah, very
point.
Much so. Yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds like a commercial thing, you know, where you have to rent everything and scope out the set and all that.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the work, in a sense, is you know, working in different modes. So each part of the entire 18-part piece will be a different kind of mode within the medium of photography.
Mm-hmm. And there's another one, briefly, there's one called G.E. Silver Lake, which is 2 shots, one of a lake and one of a old factory.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they a diptych?
Well, so the actual one of them is actually not a photograph. One of them is a digital rendering that is based on an old logo that was on this GE building. That was the High Voltage Laboratory in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And I grew up in that area, and I was really interested in sort of this industrial site that that ended up poisoning that area. There's a lot of PCBs that went into cooling of this High Voltage Laboratory. So when they tore that building down, they built what is the Silver Lake Extension, which is that landscape photograph that sits next to that photograph of the or the picture of GE. So I, based on memory and then based on some research, I discovered, you know, which GE logo it was, and then I tried to match the color scheme as best I could, so basing it off of the logo that was on that building, but that is no longer there.
And what was special about the lake? Fun fact.
It didn't freeze for many years, and then it started freezing, I think, maybe about 10 years ago or so. So I think for probably at least 20 years it wasn't freezing because of how polluted it was.
Mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Joel W. Fisher and Jess Perlitz. They're assistant professors of art at Lewis and Clark College, and their double show, Abridged Proof and Forever Washing Itself, is on now at the Hoffman Gallery through Sunday, March 18th. So, Jess, your show is in the second half. As you go through the photography show to your show, and this is sculpture. But you have sort of interactive sculpture. So this is very much it's kind of a fun show. I mean, you're encouraged to go and do things. And I think one of the most popular things when I was there was this chair with a tube going up to the seat, mm-hmm. and you could crank a handle. And just tell us exactly what happens when you crank the handle.
Yeah. So it's a steel sculpture that is welded to look. I wanted to reference a kind of a military weapon of some sort. To borrow that language, to not have a very, very clear reference to anything in specific. It's got a handle with a little arrow, so it becomes clear that you can interact with it. And it's connected to a pipe that stretches across the room and then up into the center of a chair where there's like a silver dollar-sized hole. And the idea is, obviously, that you can sit on that chair and feel the vibrations of what happens when you crank, which is that there's a hand-cranked air raid siren enclosed mm-hmm. in the steel capsule.
So it's an old-school era
yeah,
air raid siren.
I actually, like they still make them now.
Do they?
Yeah, I got it off of a survivalist website. they are meant to be handheld, and you can crank it. And, you know, the images, it looked like you could use it in case of the apocalypse, but you could also use it maybe if you were stuck in the woods hunting and you needed help. Or I'm not sure what, you store it in mm-hmm. your bunker for whenever you might need it.
Yeah.
Because it's encased in the steel piping, it makes it sound like it's quite far away. And when you sit on the chair, you can feel the vibration of it.
Mm-hmm. It's called The Calling.
It's called The Calling. So, I was thinking about it as being a kind of urgent call to action, but it's also obviously quite funny. It's got a kind of erotic, confusing side to it where you're not sure if you actually want to sit down on it, and then you're sort of wondering what that's going to feel like, and then you can't help but giggle. But at the same time, it is also like a weapon and also like a call to action. So I was sort of interested in that confusion of those feelings of passion in a way.
Mm-hmm. The show itself is called Forever Washing Itself, and then there is a piece called Forever Washing.
Right.
Which is a big foot. And tell us about the water supply. What's going on there?
So the sculpture you're referring to is called Forever Washing, and it's a concrete foot that's inside a large feed basin, big rubber feed basin. And the foot itself is actually a fountain. So water spills out just the top of the foot, sort of where the amputated ankle is, and spills very slowly, a little pathetically, down the front of the foot and over itself. And for me, that I use that as the cornerstone or touchstone for the show, as the title sort of references it and refers to, because the whole show for me was thinking about the experience of the body. And that, to me, was the most distilled example of how I've been thinking about it. And so with the forever washing itself with the actual foot sculpture, I was thinking about how potent the image of washing feet is.
You're a Catholic?
No, absolutely, I am not. So I'm not going to be able to speak that in depth about this, but I do know that it is an important image and act. But I also know that when it comes to thinking about washing one's body, that it's both an act of humility, but also it can be tied to an act of shame. And it can also be about a hope for renewal or trying to sort of start over or be fresh to wash one's self. And I liked, again, how complicated that was, mm-hmm. where it's sort of a simple act, but actually it can be both beautiful and sad and transcendent and hurt all at once. So the sculpture itself, it looks a little bit like a kind of Greco-Roman ruin as well, because it is this amputated foot, larger than life. And then there's also just something super utilitarian about a big rubber feed bucket.
Did you fabricate the foot, or did you buy it at a garden center?
The foot? I made the foot.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You molded it and, yep. and plumbed yeah. it and everything.
Yes, that is a right. hand sculpted foot.
How did you pick the scale? Because it's big.
It's big. It just felt right. I don't know how else to answer that other than that. I also did buy the largest feed bucket I could find, and I did need to. I mean, I actually made the foot first, and then thought, "Oops, I should have actually purchased this feed bucket first, because I did have to augment the foot a little bit to make it fit."
Right. So in this case, you're working. You got your own studio, or are you working in the college?
I have my own studio in Northwest in Portland.
Okay, and you can. In terms of scale, can you work on any scale? Or what are your limits? Is it space, money?
My limits are getting through doorways right now. So that's generally... there's two ways that I limit the size. One is through the doorway, and then sometimes if... depending on how I'm going to be moving and installing a sculpture. So if I know that actually I am limited to not a very large truck, I have to think about that as well. I mean, I think your question is referring to more broadly that there is a larger scale to my work. I generally do work bigger than my own body, is what I have found when I think about it. And there's just something about that physical wrestling with the materials that makes sense to me, but also that I am thinking about sculpture in terms of how it relates to the body. And so I find that once I get onto a scale that's sort of on par with us, or actually dwarfs us a little bit, that I feel like I can understand the work physically, as opposed to if it's much smaller. It feels much easier for the work to fall into representing something or mimicking something, as mm-hmm. opposed to when it's larger. If we can physically feel ourselves in relationship to it, I feel like we can understand it much more physically.
So one of the bigger pieces is called Barely There, and it's a big white mask, kind of like the comedy tragedy mask, that kind of thing, with no mouth. It's just eye holes. Is it plaster? What's it made of?
It is like plaster. It's a harder material. It's actually made out of fiberglass mm-hmm. with a kind of fiberglass reinforcing gypsum that's covering it. And it allows me to build quite large and thin. So one of the things about the sculpture, if you encounter it in person in the gallery, is that it looks very large from the front. The eye holes are actually about head height. But actually, if you stand from the side, it's remarkably thin. I think it only actually is about a foot and a half wide.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, that material allows me to build that way without actually having to build an armature inside it. And that scale was pretty important to me with the sculpture, because I wanted it to feel like a large face mask, essentially, that you could hide behind. I wanted the eyes to be at such a height that you did want to investigate it. I mean, it's pretty common that people look at it and then stand behind it to be able to look through the eye holes.
Mm-hmm.
But that that you can circle it, and so that from one side it basically disappears. It feels like a non-object, paper thin.
So from the edge, it's so thin, it's like it vanishes.
Yeah.
When you said face mask, did you mean like makeup, like a spa day?
Oh, interesting. No, but I have seen some like face that, masks right? that look like that.
It's just a white
yeah. So again, mask. You know, I think like I've talked about the previous works, it's always really important for me that it can be read in more than one way, that where I to try and use these very sort of simple images that we know, that we have these associations with, but that where those associations can get complicated quite quickly. So with Barely There, with this face mask, I was thinking about it as, yes, it's sort of like a tragedy mask, but it's also a little bit like armor. And then at the same time, it's got these eye holes that make you want to sort of stand and interact with it in a way, just to sort of see if you can be seen through it. So then you're both concealing yourself behind it as a mask, like a shield, but then you're also putting yourself on display by peeking your head through these holes and actually by being quite visible.
And also one of the popular ones was Endless Night, which was these disco balls in the corner with cushions. I think a lot of teenagers are sitting there. Why is it called Endless Night?
Endless Night. Yeah, so Endless Night is a sculpture that is actually made of 9 disco lumps, I call them, because they are disco balls that are a little bit misshapen. And they all hang from one single ceiling hang and rotate slowly at the pace of a normal disco ball, one revolution per minute. And there are 2 beanbag chairs on the floor so that you can hang out with it, because the sculpture itself is located in an alcove. So all those light sparkles that get cast off of those disco lumps are cast all along the wall and make for this beautiful kind of light show that you can lose yourself in. In that vein, like thinking about losing oneself, I was thinking about the idea of an endless night, how complicated that is as a sort of utopian notion, and also thinking about the idea of the dance floor where we typically find disco balls, and thinking about the dance floor also as this utopian place where I feel like there's this idea that one can lose oneself, and yet the body is also simultaneously so important on the dance floor. So I'm thinking about a little bit around the politics of the dance floor. If we think about the hopes or what was proposed by disco in terms of not only just civil rights, but also being able to be free of oneself, but also being able to come together, that the dance floor actually became a real politicized site and also a utopian one. And also maybe even more timeless that on the dance floor, that the body as a performance of sort of sexuality, and that actually being hoped to be a liberatory act, I think has continued throughout time on the dance floor, and how beautiful that is and also how tragic that is. So that's sort of why there are these lumps that are almost beautiful and then also misshapen.
Mm-hmm. So in the last couple of minutes, Joel will bring you back in. So you both teach at Lewis and Clark, so you've got undergraduates, you've got this access to like young imaginations, and then you've got your own work going on. What do you find is coming out of the college or the college's students that impresses you or makes you realize they're off on doing their own thing?
I don't know. I mean, my first thought is that with the students, I generally find that there's a real kindness, like an openness to wanting to allow a space for everybody's way of being and opinions. And what that allows for me as an artist and professor is that I feel like, you know, sometimes it takes some prodding, but we can actually have some really expansive conversations because students are quite ready to be open to other people's realities. So when we get to have these conversations about art, and I feel like both Joel and I approach it this way, where it's trying to get people to think about work not as sort of metaphors or symbols, but as a tool for talking about things, not only the content of the work, but what it means to actually be making the work itself, what it means to be making a photograph or a sculpture.
Yeah, I agree with all of what Jess just said, and I think one of the things that impresses me about our students is that they're not the kind of students that are really hungry to figure out how to make it in the art world. They're more curious and wanting to learn how to make meaning with what they're doing. And I think it's something that's so wonderful about being at a college like ours is that we get students that are both art students and then students that are coming in from, you know, philosophy backgrounds or computer science. And so they all bring a very different approach to thinking about how to make something. And I think that that dialogue and discussion is just absolutely worthwhile. And it's just, it's really wonderful to have there.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Joel W. Fisher and Jess Perlitz. They are assistant professors of art at Lewis and Clark College, and their shows Abridged Proof and Forever Washing Itself is on now at the Hoffman Gallery through Sunday the 18th of March. It closes at 4 p.m., so don't miss it. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Limp Wrist. Live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. Limp Wrist, four unruly lewd queens playing hardcore call for all dykes, rough girls, sissy boys, trans folks, leather teos, fierce queens, punks, the non-defined and the questioning, to come get loose at their only Northwest show. Also playing are Xylitol from Olympia and Portland's Labinden Toten and Petite. Again, that's Limp Wrist, live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Girl.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Enough National School Walkout on Wednesday, March 14th, 10 a.m. at Roseway Heights School in Portland. Enough